The great sage Sankhyayana was a chief among the transcendentalists, and when he was describing the glories of the Lord in terms of Srimad Bhagavatam, it so happened that my spiritual master, Parashara, and Brihaspati both heard him. The great sage Parashara, as aforementioned, being so advised by the great sage Pulastya, spoke unto me, the foremost of the Puranas, Bhagavatam. I shall also describe this before you, my dear son, in terms of my hearing, because you are always my faithful follower. It's very interesting here. So we have so many relationships here. Now, who's talking to who about what? In the very beginning, the first thing, who's talking? Well, a little bit later it says, Vyasa said. So it seems that Vyasa is starting the whole thing off. He's discussing everything. And he's talking about how Sutta is talking to Shonika and the rishis. And what Sutta is telling them is how he heard this from Sukadeva Goswami talking to Maharaj Parikshit. And what Maharaj Parikshit was saying Sukadeva Goswami was saying to Maharaj Parikshit is the same thing that the sages of Naimisharanya asked, apparently, which is about what happened in the conversation between Vidura and Maitreya. Okay, so it's very, very instructive. And most of the Bhagavatam, I would say the bulk of the Bhagavatam, is based upon this conversation between Vidura and Maitreya. You know, and then going back to Sukadeva Goswami giving perspective, and even more perspective going back to Sutta and Shonika. Yeah. So a very high-level discussion. So anyway, he's been talking here about, because in the last section, last chapter, of course, Vidura asked so many questions, you know, one after another. And then in 381, the great sage Maitreya said to Vidura, the royal dynasty of Puru is worth serving, is worthy to serve the pure devotees because all the descendants of that family are devoted to the personality of Godhead. You're also born in that family, and it is wonderful that because of your attempt, the transcendental pastimes of the Lord are becoming newer and newer at every moment. Let me now begin speaking on the Bhagavat Purana, which was directly spoken to the great sages by the personality of Godhead for the benefit of those who are entangled in extreme miseries for the sake of very little pleasure. Some time ago, being inquisitive to know, Sanat Kumar, the chief of the boy saints, accompanied by other great sages, and inquired exactly like you about the truths regarding Vasudeva, the Supreme, from Lord Shankarshan, who is seated at the bottom of the universe. And he's a snake, apparently. I heard his discussion yesterday. And again, he seems to be transcendental bed of somebody else, maybe. Anyway, great snake. At that time, Lord Shankarshan was meditating upon his Supreme Lord, whom the learned esteem as Lord Vasudeva. But for the sake of the advancement of the great learned sages, he slightly opened his lotus-like eyes and began to speak. The sages came from the highest planet down to the lower regions through the water of the Ganges, and therefore the hair on their heads was wet. They touched the lotus feet of the Lord, which was worshipped with various paraphernalia, by the daughters of the serpent king, and they desire good husbands. The four Kumaras, headed by Sanat Kumar, who all know the transcendental pastime of the Lord, glorify the Lord in rhythmic accents with selected words full of affection and love. At that time, Lord Sankarshan, with his thousands of raised hoods, began to radiate an effulgence from the glowing stones on his head. Wow. Lord Sankarshan thus spoke the purport of Srimad Bhagavatam to the great sage Sanat Kumar, who had already taken the vow of renunciation. Sanat Kumar also, in his turn, when inquired by Sankhyayana Muni, explained Srimad Bhagavatam as he heard it from Sankarshan. The great sage Sankhyayana was a chief amongst the transcendentalists, and when he was describing the glories of the Lord in terms of Srimad Bhagavatam, it so happened that my spiritual master, Parashara, and Brihaspati both heard him. The great sage Parashara, as aforementioned, being so advised by the great sage Pralashya. Great sage Pralashya spoke unto me, the foremost of the Puranas. So here's a kind of a side thing. Actually, it's an enzyme. It appears that Pralashya is an enzyme. He's actually not in the parampara, but he's in some ways, but he's the empowering or directing Parashya to speak it to Maitreya. Yeah. I shall also describe this before you, my dear son. So he's taking Vidura as the age of his son, in terms of my hearing, because you are always my faithful follower. So does that mean that they've had contact before? I don't know. Yeah. Okay, so that's today's verse. And tomorrow actually starts the actual Bhagavatam from Sankarshan. But today is the whole perspective, the whole value of the thing, and who's talking, and everything else like that. So maybe go on then to slide number 8, purport. Translation. The great sage, we already did this, okay. The great sage, Parashara, as aforementioned, being so advised, spoke unto me, the foremost of the Puranas, Bhagavata. I shall describe this before you, because you are my faithful follower. Okay. Wait a second, what's happening here? I'm going to get it out of order here. I'm going to pop this up. Okay. Let's go to, I think we want to go to the next slide there. Let's go try number 9, see what I've got here. Oh my goodness, okay, I got something messed up here. Anyway, so I'll just read it. Okay. The great, stay with slide number, what do you got here? Radhe. Yeah. Stay with slide number 8. Okay. There we go. Slide number 8. I think we'll catch up with that eventually. I tried to check this. I did. Okay. But anyway, okay. Purport. The great sage of the name Pralashya is the father of all demoniac descendants. Okay. I just looked up Pralashya, and he's, what is it? He's one of the, I guess, mental children of Brahma, one of the bachelor daddies of Brahma, the bachelors. And he was given some of the one of the daughters of Daksha, Javier Bhu, maybe, like that. And then from him then became the different species of Rakshashas and people like that, and so on. Okay. The great sage of the name Pralashya is the father of all demoniac species. Once upon a time, Parashara began a sacrifice in which all the demons were to be burnt to death, because his father had been killed and devoured by one of them. That's interesting. The great sage Vasishtha Muni arrived at the scene and requested Parashara to stop the deadly action. And because of Vasishtha's position and respect in the community of sages, Parashara could not deny the request. Parashara having stopped the sacrifice, Pralashya, the father of the demons, appreciated his brahminical temperament and gave him the blessing that in the future he would be a great speaker on the Vedic literatures called the Puranas. Okay, so he blessed him that he would be a great speaker on the Puranas. The supplements of the Vedas. So here we see then Pralashya was inspiring, it's inspiring. And he told you, you're going to be a great speaker on these things, so why don't you speak it to your disciple, Maitreya? Parashara's action was appreciated by Pralashya because Parashara had forgiven the demons out of his brahminical power of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Parashara was able to demolish all the demons, wow, in the sacrifice, but he considered demons are so made that they devour living creatures, men and animals, but why on that account should I withdraw my brahminical quality of forgiveness? As the great speaker of the Puranas, Parashara first of all spoke on the Srimad Bhagavatam, because it is the foremost of all the Puranas. Maitreya Muni desired to narrate the same Bhagavatam he had heard from Parashara to Vidura, who was qualified to hear it because of his faithfulness and his following the instructions received from superiors. So Srimad Bhagavatam was being narrated from time immemorial by the disciplic succession, even before the time of Vyasadeva. The so-called historians calculate the Puranas to be only a few hundred years old. But factually, the Puranas existed from time immemorial, before all historical calculations by the mundaners and speculative philosophers. Okay, let's go ahead to slide number 9. Okay, we've already discussed that one. Then let's go ahead to slide number 10. We've already done that one. So it looks like I just missed the first part there. And let's go on to the slide number 11. Okay. Okay. So this is a little interesting because this is the about the, what you know, because we have to deal with this. You know, if we're actually going to go out there, like I say, we stay in our little community and the people like that, then we'll you know have these glorifications of the Bhagavatam, these perspectives in the Bhagavatam. But again, if you just go out even to different Vaishnava sampradayas, like the Sri Sampradaya, or some of them, or Pushti Marg, or if you go, but to speak of going out to broader communities like in atheistic Indologists, you're going to find different kinds of comments. And it's nice to be able to deal with them. Prabhupada deals with them. For example, the very, very beginning of the Bhagavatam, and I think it's either the first or second purport, Prabhupada says that the modern people, they say the Bhagavatam is a modern invention, some of these modern Indologists. And they say it was invented by somebody named Gopadev or something else like that. Yeah. So here we looked on the internet and we found the www.hindupedia. I think we got the Banipedia and hindupedia.com/English/Bhopadev. The Concise Encyclopedia of Hinduism, Swami Harshananda, Ramakrishna Math, Bangalore. Okay. Bhopadev by Swami Harshananda. So what do they say? The Sanskrit language has a long history and a rich heritage. One of the innumerable writers who have contributed to its grammar and literature is Bhopadev, also spelled Bhopadev or Hopadev. He was the son of Keshava and a disciple of Dhanesha. He lived in Berar in the 13th century. Yeah? So they're saying that the Bhagavatam was actually written and composed in the 13th century. Bhopadev adorned the court of the king Mahadev of Devagiri as the chief poet. The works attributed to him are Muktapal, Hari Lila Divarana, Shatashloki, Mugda Bodha, Kavikalpa Druma. Mugda Bodha is an extremely popular primer of Sanskrit grammar. Kavikalpa Druma deals with the dhatus or verbal roots. The authorship of the most popular Purana, the Bhagavata, is sometimes attributed to him, though available evidence seems to weigh heavily against this theory. So I think this is something that's happening, is that, you know, we're wondering, what's the result of our movement? Have we had any result? How many people in America are actually becoming devotees when we look around us like this and that? You know? But I think many things. We really participated a lot in the formation of the hippie movement, which brought words like karma and guru and so many things right into American culture. Yeah. And beyond that, for example, in South America, rhyme traveling, devotees, a lot of grihastas, they had a very, very nice little booklet which showed some yoga postures. Then it had like a vegetarian diet and some recipes. And they distributed hundreds of thousands of these things, and people liked them sometime. And it's a good income and a good preaching program. So practically speaking, there's nobody in South America, maybe the Grand Fraternal Order or something, some few groups, but very small really, who were preaching vegetarianism like Prabhupada's disciples and followers. You know? But now we see it. So many places down there are, you know, vegetarian restaurants and different groups like that. And really, there's been no, like, genocides, you know, for a long time. It seems that we actually were involved in one big strike there. All the students and professors were on strike, and they were hundreds of thousands in the streets and the police, and went on for several weeks closing universities. And so we were talking to one professor, and he said this happened when I was a youth also. He said, but then it got so violent that people were killing each other. But he said, now they seem to be able to listen to each other. So it really seems that we've done something, you know, in all of our efforts and austerities, really something subtle, And here, of course, in this intellectual atmosphere, I think we've seen the same thing happening. Because when Prabhupada was writing, people were saying, oh, yes, the Bhagavata is a very excellent work composed by the great scholar Bhopadeva from the 13th century. Yes, some of the things are older, but, you know, blah, blah. Okay, yeah. So, and so then we see that even a Ramakrishna sannyasi from the Ramakrishna Mat is saying that this theory appears to be, you know, well, what's the word? That the evidence seems to weigh heavily against this, you know. We did a program at the the National Museum in Calcutta. I think it's the oldest branch. A very nice program. And so there was a sannyasi there from the Ramakrishna Mission. And the topic was, what does India have to contribute to the modern world? And he said that Ramakrishna pointed out India's greatest tradition, which is that we are all God. Okay. So then the Sannyasi Maharaj from the Bhag Bazar Gaudiya Math, he got up and he said, actually, we're not all God, we're all godly. Like that, you know. And after that, the Ramakrishna Sannyasi, and I don't think it was out of just like respect, it was out of like, politeness. I think it was actually because he's actually accepting, you know, that. He also said, we're all godly. So I would say that many, many places, other people, one time, Brahmananda had been invited, was associating with Ramakrishna Sannyasi, and he wanted to go with him and spend the summer with him. And he told him, no, it's just going to be a retreat, mostly old ladies, you become bored, you know. So he was talking to Prabhupada about the sannyasi, and Prabhupada said, yes, I know him. He's a good man. He's just in the wrong movement, like that, so on. Okay, so there are many good people in many places who externally may not be in good situations. But when the ideas come, they take them up if they're reasonable, they're honest. That's the foremost characteristic there. Yeah. So then also, there's also a, if you go to the next slide here, I think it's there, in order. Okay, slide number 12. Okay, and here we have www.jayarama.us, which is our webpage, /archives, which is our jungle of stuff, sbh.pdf. Okay. What that will get you is an article done by Professor Edwin Francis Bryant, whose Hare Krishna name was Advaita Das. You may know him. Okay. So Edwin Francis Bryant is an American Indologist. Currently, he is Professor of Religions of India at Rutgers University. So he's still involved with devotees, you know, in many ways like that. But he wrote this article called The Date and Provenance of the Bhagavad Purana. So how old is it, and where is it from? What's its province, you know, like that. And it's an incredible article, so nice. One of our friends, Dr. Samaresh Bandopadhyaya, he was head of the Department of Ancient Indian History and Culture at Calcutta University. And he accepted it as a very, very authoritative, sober article, you know, and gave him some even more perspective on the age of the Bhagavata. So he gives very, very beautiful, you know, a description of the history of the Bhagavata and different arguments about its age, and it's pushing it back, at least, you know, what, maybe 500 years before what they surely say it should be, 600 years, 700, at least, you know, like that. So, and then about the Bhopadeva thing, Radhika, so he was like always seeing scholars mentioning, you know, the Bhagavata and the Bhopadeva. And he kept going around this way and that way. And I think it was because of Advaita's article here that actually he came back to the original citation. You know, the first guy, because A is citing B is citing C is citing D, and D is citing E. Okay, so the first guy who actually said this, who everybody else is citing without too much, discrimination, he said in one book, not even in the book, like in just some kind of end note, he kind of mentioned as a secondary thing. He said, I think that the Bhagavata might have been, you know, Bhopadeva might have been involved in the composition of the Bhagavata. It's totally tenuous thing like that and so on. But anyway, Bhopadeva himself mentions the Bhagavata and glorifies it. And other than that, he's not a very egotistical person, apparently. And so for him to be glorifying the work, it seems he didn't compose it, you know. So anyway, this is one point about what they say in the history of the Bhagavatam. This article is very nice, very authoritative. I give it to people. in terms of the age of the Bhagavatam and so on. But here we see that our parampara is a Brahma Sampradaya. But it appears that this Bhagavatam we're talking about now is actually Kumar. It is actually Kumar Sampradaya, because it's coming from Vishnu, the same as our Bhagavatam, but it's coming down through the Kumaras, like that, and so on. So this is interesting. It's like, what do we have then? We're having Maitreya Muni as being cited by Sukadeva Goswami. So Sukadeva Goswami is accepting evidence from other Sampradaya, you know, into his Bhagavatam, like that. But the authority is, of course, his parampara, his father, and things like that. Okay. Next slide, sir. It's number, 13? Yeah. You got it? Oh, we didn't do that? Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I got it. Okay, I see it now. Okay. Okay. So now here we went on forgiveness, because the Encyclopedia Britannica, I don't think it had anything. The Britannica didn't have anything, so we went to the Wikipedia. Apparently they asked the director of the Britannica, what do you think about the Wikipedia? And he laughed and said, I use it. Yeah. He said, the Wikipedia is like a chisel, and the Britannica is like a drill. Okay. But Wikipedia can give you so much information about things and some sources. But, you know, sometimes you can really see like how it's very much politically motivated or things like that. So you can go to Britannica, and there they have it's accepted in what we call in scholarly circles and so on. Of course, from our perspective, and even everybody's perspective, many people also criticize the articles in there as not being perfect. You know? But it's accepted in universities and so on, like that, especially if you cite the person who wrote the article, which you're including sometimes. So Wikipedia was very nice, you know, in my class, easy. It says here, forgiveness, which is, of course, the quality that for which Parashara is being glorified, forgiveness is the intentional and voluntary process by which a victim undergoes a change in feelings and attitude regarding an offense, lets go of negative emotions such as vengefulness, and with an increased ability to wish the offender well. Such a nice definition. I've heard that Prabhupada arrived late in France one time, you know, traveling, and then he went to his, you know, came to the temple, and he had a supper for him. And then I think he asked for some ice cream or something. So they ran outside and got some and brought it back, and Prabhupada was taking it. And he said, oh, very nice. Who made this? You know, the devotees were afraid. They said, oh, my gosh, Prabhupada, we got it from the outside, but it doesn't have anything bad in it, like that and stuff. You know, then Prabhupada said, where's it go? Oh, there are devotees everywhere. Just see, there are devotees everywhere. He said, you can't do anything nice without devotion. Yeah. So you find this, you probably check whoever wrote this, actually is maybe a devotee, you know, maybe a devotee of Jesus or something. Yeah, something. Okay, but a very nice definition, no? Forgiveness is the intentional and voluntary process by which a victim undergoes a change in feelings and attitude regarding an offense. Let's go of negative emotions such as vengefulness with an increased ability to wish the offender well. And then if you go look up, they have many subsections, actually a big article, big article. So I looked up the Hindu thing on forgiveness, and it says, in Vedic literature and epics of Hinduism, kshama or shayama, Sanskrit kshama, and fusion words based on it describe the concept of forgiveness. So, of course, when we're describing the brahminical qualities in the Bhagavad Gita, what is it? Kshama, dama, taposo, cham. Okay. So the very first one is shama, or forgiveness. The theological basis for forgiveness in Hinduism, is that a person who does not forgive carries a baggage of memories of the wrong or negative feelings of anger and unresolved emotions that affect his or her present as well as future. I'm sure we agree with that, but it's an interesting declaration. You know, they didn't give any footnote on that. Okay, then they quote from the Mahabharata where it says, forgiveness is virtue. Forgiveness is sacrifice. Forgiveness is the Vedas. Forgiveness is the Shruti. Forgiveness protecteth the ascetic merit of the future. Forgiveness is asceticism. Forgiveness is holiness. And by forgiveness, it is that the universe is held together. Such a nice program. We have nice literature, the Mahabharata, other things like that. Yeah. So, of course, it's a very, very big topic. Yeah, big topic. And might even we're saying it's one of the foremost qualities. I've even heard the Prabhupada said this is the Brahmins, that tolerance, patience, you know, forgiveness is the foremost quality of a Brahmin, like that, foremost quality of a Brahmin. So very, very big topic. And of course here that's the attribute by which Parashara Muni then got benedicted, you know, blessed by Pralashti to become the speaker of the Bhagavatam. So in terms of our own ability to do sankirtan, our own desire to do something for Krishna, to do some sankirtan for Krishna, you can see that forgiveness may be very essential for us being empowered. Go to the next slide then. Add the thought here. Okay. Slide number 14. Okay. Chaitanya Charitamrita on Chilila 2021. Trinadapi suniche na taroriva sahishnuna amanina amanadena kirtaniya sadahari. So I think maybe in terms of the mantras, we might have Hare Krishna mantra, Panchatapa mantra, Hariharaya mantra. And this may be maybe the third mantra that we want to memorize and take to heart. Of course, Lord Chaitanya says one should string the holy names on the thread of this mantra and wear it around his neck. And this is how to chant. Utsaha nishchaya daryat tata karma pravartana sangas yaga. So we should be tolerant, we should be determined, we should, you know, what else? We should be enthusiastic, you know. But here we should be more humble than the grass. Trinad, the grass, api su nichena. So niche means below. Yeah. Piche means behind. It's very interesting because it also matches the word nether regions. Tanadapi su nichena. Taror, the tree, iva, then sahishnuna. So tolerant, utsaha nishchaya daryat. Daryat. Tanadapi su nichena. Taror iva sahishnuna. So we're very, very small, very humble, to always taking the humble position in terms of who gets fed first, who gets the most respect for their brains, you know, all these things, taking a very humble position. And then in terms of adversity, of course, he gives the example, the tree gets cut down, it gets burned by the sun, you know, so many things happen to it, you know, but it always gives fuel, aromatics, fruits, shade, you know, to anybody who goes by there, maybe he's dying of thirst, you know, doesn't complain. Amanina. Okay. Manina. I think manina means honor, respect, you know, fame, prestige. Amanina. So we don't want any fame or respect or prestige. Manadena. You know? But we want to give that mana. There it is, mana. Yeah, we want to give the mana to others. Not expecting any respect, but giving respect to others. Kirtaniya sadahari. Okay. So here then is, and we have different kinds of offenses, you know, different kinds of people, you know, offending us, harassing us, hurting us, you know. And I think it's offensive kind of when we take it as not being justified. I don't deserve to be harassed like this, you know. But very, very simple solution to this in the first place is that if we're quick enough, you know, and careful enough, then as Madhyamadikaris, we make friendship with the devotees, preach to the innocent, worship God, and we avoid the demons, avoid our demoniac thoughts, avoid our demoniac reactions, avoid our demoniac intelligence, you know? Avoid the demoniac in other religious people. They're 50% good, 50% bad. So we avoid that. And if we do that, then we don't become offended, right? Yeah, we can always see that I'm not the target. Somebody is yelling at you, and you realize they're not really yelling at you at all. They have some very strong conception in their mind, and you just happen to kind of fit the bill 5% or something. You know, they could be yelling at anybody. You know, see, then you don't take offense. You know, so there's no forgiveness required like that, because you haven't got to forgive anybody, because you never bothered you in the first place. Ultimately, everybody is good. Ultimately, everybody is part and parcel of Krishna. So Uttamadhikari, he sees how everybody is ultimately properly situated. Some of us are situated in the external energy, and so then we're reacting in certain ways like that. You know, so when Narada Muni is giving advice to Kamsa to kill the babies and this and that, he's seeing, you know, how this is good. He's not going to learn any other way, and Krishna is carrying all these lilas. And ultimately, there's a lot of probably funny things that Narada Muni sees about the whole thing, like that. And so it's actually quite delightful, you know. Yeah. So if Kamsa is rough with Narada or rude or anything else, it doesn't bother him, you know, so on. You know? So we don't have anything to forgive. Yeah. And even if we do get hit by something because we're not careful like that, and become disturbed by the person, offended, you know, then again with our intelligence, we can look at the situation and consider, you know, different aspects like that, you know, and why the person did it, adopt the same attitude and see what's happening and how it's in terms of Krishna's desire. And then we can very easily forgive them because we understand there's just no reason to be upset, you know. I mean, we just take it as our own inability, our own attachment is why we had any kind of offense in the whole thing at all. Narada Muni was talking to Daksha, and Daksha was upset with him because he had given sannyas to so many of his sons, like this and that. And Narada Muni, and he started insulting Narada. So that's not good for his spiritual life. You know, Narada Muni should have avoided that and smiled and gone away. Yeah. But Narada Muni knew that Daksha was a very, very pious person. Very pious. And because of that, he would feel bad because he made himself sensitive. He made himself, you know, a fine gentleman. And therefore, he knew he would react, you know, to these rough things. And sure enough, after some time, he apologized to Narada and this and that. I was able to listen. So different things in terms of offenses and forgiving them and not forgiving them. You know, sometimes like a king, well, Prabhupada says, for example, a devotee is naturally willing to forgive anything. Like the Kauravas are coming there and offending Arjuna. They're insulting his wife, they're insulting his brother, big brother. And very, very, you know, offensive attitude. You know? But Arjuna is willing to forgive them, even at that point. Prabhupada said this is a sign of a good man, but he says sometimes no. It's not good for the other party. It's not good for the offenser. You know, we're hurting them. We're actually being offensive and hurting them. You know, by not seeing who they are, that they really are great personalities and stuff. So then, you know, Prabhupada says we should not forget to become violent, angry, at least for some time, to drive away the wrongdoers. You know. But we always remember this is for their welfare, for that welfare. Then, of course, we can react to the offense by not forgiving it or avoiding it, but actually by chastising the person, trying to bring them to the proper consciousness and so on. Of course, that has to be done expertly. Otherwise, there'll be a bad taste for everybody afterwards. So we can always take shelter, Kirtaniya Sadahari, and always just chant Hare Krishna, and then Krishna and Balaram will make their adjustment. Because even though a great Paramahamsa, he may forgive an offensive attitude, like, what's his name, something Khan, Ramachandra Khan, whatever his name was, he offended Lord Nityananda, right? But he offended Haridas Thakur first, right? Tried to seduce him and humiliate him and everything else. You know? So he committed a great offense. And Haridas Thakur just took it as like an ignorant fellow and, you know, went away without offense. You know? But Krishna didn't take it that way, you know. And neither the guru, Nityananda. Yeah, yeah. So it says that a great soul, Paramahamsa, he may forgive these things because that's who he is. You know? But the offender then will not be condemned by him, but he will be condemned by the dust of his lotus feet. Right? Condemned by the dust of his lotus feet, like that, and so on. So in many, many perspectives on this point. Also, I remember one very, very nice thing. I like the Peter Brook Mahabharata too. I just can not perfect. I definitely think it's. I've used it many times with great good effect for Western preaching and stuff to bring people to a more deeper perspective. But in there, of course, all these we call it vows and counter vows and Bhima, this big guy from Africa, like the wind. He promises that he'll rip open Dushasana's like stomach or something and drink his blood or his heart. Open his heart. Yeah. So in the movie, they do a real good job of this, you know, with some on-stage effects. And he rips it open, he's screaming and stuff. It's really well done. Then they got it set up, so it looks like, you know, he's actually done. Then they cut close to his face, and he's all covered with scratches from gravel and dust and, you know, in the middle of a combat. And then all over his face is his blood, you know. And he says, my enemy's blood is sweeter than my mother's milk. So maybe, I don't know, maybe sometimes there is scope for a little bit of revenge, a little bit of vengeance and against the wrongdoers. Take that, you demons. So a broad topic like that. But that's it. After that, even the movie, after he does that and kind of like, you know, tase him for what he did, which was very terrible. And for what he did to Draupadi, Dushasana is probably going to suffer a long time. But having it all like having, you know, being chastised by Bhishma, and the correctional forces say, okay, it happened, okay. And that's it. Okay, then he covers him over. He does a real emotional, you know, dance there, bouncing a couple times. Then he says, good, it's kind of like, farewell, my cousin. We weren't born to be happy. Yeah. Very nice, strong presentation. These images are what comes up. No, we have logical understanding, but the logical understanding, you're not going to be able to make it in terms of fast-moving reality. So we need very, very strong icons, images and stuff, which will catch us and direct us and guide us in the middle of all these things like that. And selecting which ones we're going to keep in our consciousness like that, which iconographic images and so on. So next slide. Maybe it's the last one here. Oh, there it is. I didn't go to you. Okay. So number 15. Okay, so that's our little thoughts about this verse. Maybe somebody else has some profound thoughts and will forgive
okay.
us for Maharaj, this presentation.
Very nice class. Just can you hold on a moment?
I can. I'll forgive you for making me wait.
Maharaj, you know what? Harsh Prabhu actually had the first question coming in, and he's got several of them. So can I tell you his questions first?
I think I can look at them here.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Then I have to...
You know, I'm online. I'm just not using the audio because the audio overloads my
Doom. Okay, so here. I'm sticking these in the chat. And there's one more coming. Just one second.
One. What is the difference between blessing and well-wishing? how blessing works. Okay, I guess we look at the... What is the difference between blessing and well-wishing? One time Prabhupada talks about different kinds of friends. He says suhrit, mitra, like that. And there's different levels of things. And one means that you're just well-wishing. You know, we hope you do well, and I'm really, you know, thinking about you and this kind of thing. But another one, blessing, comes more to the point of like specific detail, specific content, and specific well-wishing. So I would say that just in kind of general, that well-wishing is more general and blessing is a specific, you know, well-wishing somebody in a specific topic, in a specific way like that. And how do blessings work? Well, everything's personal, so I have some, you know, some stock of credits with different personalities, the fire god, the wind god, Saraswati. And so when I bless you or ask that you do well, then it seems that those higher authorities are going to cooperate, you know, and then they're going to give you knowledge, give you strength, give you health, like that, and so on. So that's what I would say, how it works. Number two. What time is it now? It's 10:30 at night in Delhi, Bombay, Maharshi's. My goodness. Does humble position mean the last position? Ramananda. Okay, his humble position being the last position. Well, actually, again, I understand the question here. This is with the point of Jayananda. He was very famous for being humble. Yeah. And he said that humility doesn't mean to be artificially big or artificially small, either one. Humble means to actually fit into your position. Oh, Prabhu, I'm the most fallen. I can't do anything. You're not the most fallen. You can do something. Yeah. And so it's a fact. And we can say, I'm simply made of Krishna's mercy. Well, part of that mercy is to give us eternal potency and creativity. There's always increasing and so on like that. You know? So some degree, yeah, Krishna depends upon us. You know? We have individual potencies and abilities which he's are manifest to us only. You know? And so we have humble means then to find out what is our position. Sometimes humble means that you take charge of everybody else and say, hey, look, guys, look, we're going to stop doing this. Come here. Come here. I want to talk to you and then tell you some, like, how I think we should handle this. You know? And, hey, be humble. I am being humble. Yeah. And everybody accepts, okay, that's, but he has a service attitude, right? You know, somebody like Arjuna, he's directing people, protecting them, you know, out of a humble attitude towards them. You know, they're better than I am in so many ways. I have some insignificant quality that I can offer, like that. You know? So, yeah, it doesn't mean being the last or the least. It means understanding what your actual position is, as we understand. How and what do you mean by avoiding demon in self and others? Well, in self, in the self, self-atma. You're talking about the senses. For example, we have demoniac conditionings in our senses. So somebody who's maybe raised up in a heavy meat-eating family, when he smells, you know, barbecue spare ribs and this, his senses are attracted. You know? And so then we have to avoid that. We've got to get them engaged in something else. The attraction is there, the movement's there, so we engage them in something else, give them something else to eat. And the mind can react the same way. And the intelligence, like in Narahari's, you get the intelligence can react the same way. It can analyze things from a certain demoniac perspective. You know, I'm the God, I'm the controller, my friends are great, they all tell me so. You know? And so then we avoid that. You know, we don't get sucked up into it or caught into it. We understand it. We understand our attitude, our intelligence, our perspective. That by what? By being on the spiritual platform. You know, by having a spiritual attitude, by chanting Hare Krishna. You know? And then we can see, you know, this is my demoniac intelligence, my demoniac mind, my demoniac senses. No, there, the conditioning is there. And every day Maya is putting it in, you know. And other people, of course, the same thing is there in their mind, body, and words, too. So Madhya Madhikari may be half mad. So we avoid the crazy part of other devotees and deal with the same part. Okay. One more here. My child is howling. How can I unmute? How can I unmute? I don't understand. Yeah, your child is howling. Yeah.
Oh, no, I cannot unmute him. Narahari Prabhu, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Did you want...
Okay.
Am I unmuted?
Yeah,
yes, you're unmuted.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask... Maharaji talked a lot about humility, which is a really, you know, an important principle in advancing spiritual life. You talked about how we should string Trinada Pisunichina around our necks. But Madan Mohan one time commented, it always sort of sticks in my mind, he said that humility is like a mystic power. I mean, you can't just become humble. When being in this world, we've come here to try to usurp the position of Krishna, and we're so much contaminated with pride and arrogance, and just by nature, every living being in this world is somehow puffed up. It seems to me that the only way we can really become humble is by the very gradual process of following the principles of sadhana. And as we gradually become purified, then humility, which is a natural quality of the soul, will once again manifest itself. But it just doesn't seem to me that there's anything we can do to just, you know, press a button and become humble. We can act it out, we can, you know, externally, you know, bow down and you know, we know the right things to say and the right things to do, you know, but to genuinely be humble, as Madan says, like a mystic power, you know, unless you've truly, you know, purified your heart. What do you have to say on that?
No, again, Upadeshamrita, number 3, Prabhupada says, devotional service is not a matter of sentimental speculation or imaginative ecstasy, but it is practical activity in the foreground of spiritual life. So exactly what you're saying, like, you know, practical for the gopis is different than practical for Lakshmi, which is different than practical for somebody else, you know, coming down like that. So again, taking Jayananda's definition, that humble means to understand your position and act accordingly, then we can find it in Buddha Yoga. You know, if we're willing to do Buddha Yoga, we can think about our position, our nature, and then we can be humble, and we can control our mind by our intelligence. Because our mind might be, you know, wanting to see itself as being the greatest and everything else, but our intelligence says, no, this is how it is, this is it. And the mind then accepts, you know, becomes controlled. So on different levels, I think, yeah, we can do it. We can be humble. And we can be humble. But like you're saying in the beginning, maybe it's just externally we're doing it. We smile, we don't say bad things. But then we start to control our mind, comes arrogance and the exact opposites. And then our intelligence, because we've submitted to the Bhagavad Gita, and we have the intelligence coming from the Bhagavad Gita, you know, then that's also being humble. And being humble is to accept Krishna's opinion rather than our opinion. But ultimately, yeah, it comes from the soul, it comes from good association, and there are different levels of it. It's a complicated thing like that, you know. But that level, I say, yeah, we can be humble, you know, by an effort like that and so on.
Maharaj, two things. One, I guess I have to defend that a little bit because the mystic power. Sometimes
are you being humble? Are you being humble?
Well, I've replaced the word humble by humbled. I don't think.
Okay.
That's helpful.
Nobody's really humble, but everybody gets a chance to be humbled. And then after you're humbled, then you can be humble. But I was also, two things. Prabhupada's definition was not being anxious to have the satisfaction of being honored by others. In the 13:8 through 12, process of knowledge, because he says when one's in the bodily conception of life, they naturally are anxious to have some honor in society. But when you're thinking, I'm acting in such a way that I want to please Prabhupada, I want to please Krishna, they're the ones that are watching, and I have a type of chastity to please them. So like sometimes the chaste wife doesn't interact with others because they have the one master, or in the analogy form of ancient understanding, that I'm here to please Prabhupada and Krishna, so I don't act necessarily to try to please everyone. Of course, when you Krishna, you are pleasing everyone, but it was coming out of the Bali conception of life, being independent and just acting as dependent. But I'm dependent on their mercy, so I'm always conscious of that and acting relationship. And in that sense, it is mystic in the way that we don't in Krishna consciousness, but it makes us that's being involved that most people aren't aware of. But and in that sense, it is mystic that you're to the your relationship to Krishna and Prabhupada and acting in that way. So that's who I'm trying to please, and that single-pointedness could be understood as humility. How's that sound right?
No, it sounds great. Was it Brahmande Brahmatikom Bhagyavanji Guru Krishna Prasadi Paya Bhakti Lata Beej? So Krishna is the aggressor. He's humbling Indra. He's giving us the Bija the bija of humility. Huh? What about that? He's giving us the bija of the humility, but then we have to water it. You know, we have to do something in terms of, you know, cultivating a humble attitude. Or finally, of course, that's the point where it gets beyond the mind, the senses, where it actually becomes a manifestation of us personally. You know? But I would say that in every situation, Krishna is the what's it called? There's eight aspects to bhava. Vibhava. Krishna is the vibhava for everything. So he stimulates it, but then, you know, then we have to water the seed ourselves, like that, and so on.
Hi, Bo.
May I say something, please? Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, please accept my humble obeisances.
Accept my obeisances.
I was thinking, doesn't humility come, or one learns to become humble, when we go through trials and maybe we don't do so well, and then we can see, we become introspective and start to honestly assess where we're at. You know, I know, at least for myself, the material desires I'm just no way near a pure platform, and then you see, Srila Prabhupada and his examples, and read about other Vaishnava saints, and I think gradually, isn't it that when we become more advanced, we begin to see honestly where we're really at, and then it's easier to feel that way. Feel lower than a blade of grass and more humble than a tree. Is that one way?
I would say what Jayananda was saying, yeah, that, like you're saying the same thing, is it just that, yeah, we begin to realize our position, because as Madan was saying, we become humbled. I was saying that Krishna is the aggressor, he gives the bija, like that, you know?
Yeah, and then not seeing that we're the big doers either. You know, I think Srila Prabhupada, there was an example where Tamal Krishna Maharaj kind of thought he was a big something, and Prabhupada humbled him. He said, we're like tiny ants, you're a tiny ant, and then there's like this big country, and then there's the earth, and then there's the solar system, and then the giant universe, and this tiny little insignificant particle, spirit soul, is named Tamal Krishna Maharaj, and he thinks he's really something.
The sun comprises, according to Britannica, the sun comprises 99% of all the mass in the solar system. and then we're here on the earth, right? And what percentage of the mass of the earth we comprise, you know, everything else, yeah. Okay, but Krishna is very attentive. Krishna is very attentive. Okay, Hari Bol.
Gandhiji.
Hari Bol. So, Madan's statement was true, and Prabhuji, when he first mentioned that the real humility comes in our maturation of Krishna consciousness, also true. There is a verse that supports it. I've seen it quoted in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, but I think it's from Bhakti Sandarbha. It says, Pari Pokena Danasya Krishna Prema Aja Sanvitanyate. So it says that Danya Bhav, Danya means humility, it becomes pakka or ripe as we become in Krishna consciousness, in Krishna Prema. But then the second line says, Parasparam apietan. But in fact, one nourishes the other, which means as you become more and more Krishna conscious, more and more of the real element of danya or humility comes. So it comes completely when we're situated in spiritual perfection, but elements of it come as we're progressing. Then it says, karya karya mikshate. You will see that one is truly the cause of the other. So actually, it is true that the real, actual humility comes in the perfection of Krishna consciousness. Also, it's interesting that when you read the elements of surrender, saranagati, the last line says, Amanikshepa Karpanya. In other words, the humility is actually stated last. You would think that if it was something that came in the beginning of bhakti, it would be right up there in the beginning. But it's actually the last line of the verse, which indicates humility itself is the symptom that now spiritual perfection is coming. Because that humility, genuine in relation to the devotee's experience of Bhagavan. As he experiences Krishna, he becomes overwhelmed by humility. I think Maharaj, like you're saying, oh, what is my position? And even Didi, she just now mentioned, in relation to Srila Prabhupada and so many great saints and sadhus, oh, what am I? You know?
Smaller than ant. What's his name? There's a guy, William Blake, an English poet. He said, even fleas have little fleas that bite them. Yes.
Yeah. Very nice.
Hare Krishna. Yeah. I put it into everything else. Okay, William Blake, good job. So again, maybe we should, in all humility, keep the schedule here and
just
here it is then.
Just something that came up in the class that I liked, some reference to the Indologists. And Advaita, he's a Prabhupada disciple.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
The professor.
Yeah, he was in the Jamaica and every place else where guys had hunted, but making life members and stuff.
Okay, so Gopur Vindipal, Prabhu, godbrother of ours here, he said he read a book where an Indologist fessed up on his deathbed about the rewrite of the history of India. And the British, they could not tolerate that there was a culture more ancient or greater than theirs. So they engaged some men in the Writers' Building, it's still there in Calcutta, that had no background in, you know, no qualification really to write such history. They had no background in anthropology, archaeology, no discipline, no qualification. They're just engaged writing to change the dates traditionally held to be the dates of the ancient scriptures like the Bhagavatam. And also Krishna Bhakti. You know, they just started to move the dates up. And they also engaged Max Müller, a Sanskritist, a German Sanskritist, and others to bewilder some Indian scholars, to get them on board. And it was a conscious effort to rob the Indian people of their cultural heritage. I mean, the Muslims did a lot of damage in India, but the British may have done the one up them. They stole the wealth of India, but they, to subjugate them, they made an attempt to disfigure and confuse the real culture of India. So this is still a problem today, and it should be addressed. And it was good that this one devotee took the time to research and publish an article, at least on the Bhagavatam.
There's actually quite a bit of work going on. For example, in ISKCON, there's the, what's it called? ISKCON Studies something or other. I think they're meeting every year. And it's all these people who, that's, you know, they feel, they're into this area, you know, and other people are cooks and they're preaching like anything. But these devotees are all devotees who are doing like, you know, doctorates on Gaudiya Vaishnavism and all this kind of stuff. And they discuss about what's the first area to write in, what's the most important area. So it is an active area in ISKCON, and it's a whole matter of trying to, like you say, like coordinate the branches. So we got good food and we also got, you know, good logic. I knew one professor in India, he was a historian, and his comment was, he said that when the Muslims came, their thing was worship our God. That was what they were running around with, that was their theme. Don't worship your God, worship our God. You know. He said when the British came, it was worse because the British just marginalized religion. And they said it's just kind of a secondary thing a gentleman does and just worship our government and so on. So that the British, was he was concerned, did a worse job on than the Muslims. And like you say, there was so much espionage and everything else involved like that, and so much subtle work. Was it the British won both world wars, apparently, I've heard, because of espionage and everything else, and so many comments like that. Yeah. Yeah. So, propaganda at every level. Good food, good prasadam, good intellectual research. There's a whole thing with the American Association for Religions, which, of course, is the biggest, one of the biggest agencies. They have a meeting every year in so many sections, you know, divisions. And right now, Radhika's chairman of the Hindu-Christian dialogue section like that and so on, you know. And there's so much going on. So what we're trying to do, of course, in South America is, because it's a good ambience, you know, it's a Christian ambience, but a little bit more, less impersonal. And we're trying to organize this program on psychology of the sacred, which will allow people to at least, you know, consider God and religion from a meditational point of view, introspective point of view, getting off the gyan level and the ritual level, and come to the point of actual, you know, contemplation of the thing. Yeah, you know. And then maybe then stimulate people to have more depth stuff. Other than that, in the end of, what is it, of May? I think it's the end of May, March, April, May. Maybe end of April. The end of April, Radhika and Anutama are especially working on a program with Harvard School of Divinity, which, of course, is one of the most famous Indologist groups in the entire world. And Francis Clooney, who's the director now, is a nice person. He's helping so much. And it's a review. They're going to invite very, very you know, responsible scholars to look at ISKCON and how it's presented Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy. What is Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy? And like a good critical thing. We don't want just like, you know, you've done this and that good, but what have been the mistakes that have been made? But not like destructive, but actually like that. So that should be a very, very, you know, useful, good conference in this area. Anything else? One more thing. I forgot what it is anyway. Yeah. But so, yeah, a lot of nice work going on, and a lot of it involves this stuff of going back to, like, the previous historical documents and so on, and researching them and showing, like you're saying, that people themselves directly said that we've been employed, you know, to misdirect this stuff. Or like taking Bopadev, that Papa mentions him, and going back and showing, exactly showing that, you know, that this is how it happened. You know, one guy said this, and everybody else, without thinking, and follows it like that, and so on. Yeah. Okay, so I guess I should go ahead with the time. Well, also, it's one way to be humble, is to accept the schedule given by the Acharya. You know, Papa gives us a schedule, and if we accept that, then that's being humble. You know, also somebody asked Papa, what does being humble mean? He says, follow the four principles. So thank you very much.
Jai.
And I hope you, yeah.
Well, thank you, Maharaj.
Jai.
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna, mates.
Jai. Oh, Boris and Srila Prabhupada. Thank you,
Prabhupada.
Jai. Hare Krishna.